This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host Nellie Bailey is on vacation. Coming up, a federal court gives the okay to President Obama's preventive detention policies. A man who spent years in solitary confinement assesses the California prison hunger strike. And Dr. Cornel West speaks on Trayvon Martin and the Black leadership class. But first, Black college enrollment has risen dramatically in the last decade, but most of the increase has come from for-profit colleges that mire young people in debt with no jobs at the end of the process. Journalist Kai Wright is author of an article entitled Young, Black, and Buried in Debt, How For-Profit Colleges Prey on African-American Ambitions. Wright says the education corporations have set a trap for desperate people.
Yeah, they have. And, you know, and I have to say that for me, it's actually broader than the for-profit colleges. I came to this piece because I was looking into specifically one large company called Career Ed Corporation based out of Illinois. They're one of the largest for-profit schools in the country. They do everything from, you know, cooking schools on through to health degrees. And they have been under investigation by a number of states and a number of accrediting bodies for the shoddy education they provide at the same time as offering a high cost that is largely paid for in federally Black student loans. And like all the rest of these schools, they very aggressively target African Americans in particular, but low-income folks altogether. And so I started off looking at career ed and their problems in New York State in particular. But, you know, it quickly became for me a reminder of all of these stories that I've reported over the last, you know, decade or so that began with subprime credit cards coming out of the 2001 recession targeting African-American communities, ran through subprime mortgages, runs through payday lending and rent-to-own and all of the $5 short-term high interest rate loans that are made and now on into schools. And there is a tens of billions of dollar industry in each of those. A small version is $30 billion, and that's the payday loan industry, making hand over fist money off of targeting African Americans who are buying first and foremost, and this is what you hit on at the beginning here, Glenn, is they're buying first and foremost ambition. And that's what becomes so insidious about it. They're preying on our community's desire to, as we say, do better at a time when we have been just battered by recession and job loss since 2001 and looking for whatever is the answer to, oh, how can I better myself? So the latest is, oh, you should go get another accreditation, you should go get another degree, and it's going to cost you tens of thousands of dollars for an associate's degree that you'll never get a job for.
And the similarities, as you point out in your article, between for-profit educational institutions and subprime mortgages, the similarities are striking.
They really are quite striking. I mean, I was watching one of the ads for, again, Career Ed, their school, the Sanford Brown Institute in New York State. It's a health degree, health associates. And every frame, as you watch through the ad, is, you know, a young Black woman, a young woman of color. There's this montage of voices that say, there are sort of a montage of working class woes, right? Oh, I was working second shift. Oh, I needed to do better for my family. But then they come to these voices that start saying, you know, how did I feel about myself? I didn't feel like I was doing enough. I didn't feel like I was really a legitimate part of society. I mean, I'm paraphrasing at this point. And those are the very same kinds of things that I heard and saw when we were watching these subprime loans be peddled in Black communities all across the country. You know, I was struck by, back in 2008, I think it was 2007, 2008, I was sitting in a woman's house in Atlanta who was about to lose her home, and she was describing how she had the home for decades and somehow had gotten caught up in all of these subprime refinances. And I was trying to understand how what happened, how she fell for it. And she described, you know, this young Black man that came by, he was all of the things that you could see as she talked that she wanted to see in a young Black man from the South. And based on her aspirations for him, she trusted him. And there's a lot of that same thing going on in, I call them subprime degrees as well. And you also see it in the payday lending industry, and you also see it in subprime credit cards. It's a similar marketing tactic where you play on people's ambition, you trick them into a terrible deal that also preys upon the fact that they're not as informed about what their options are and that they're desperate.
This type of ethnic marketing appears to be paying off for some of these colleges. You say that the top producers of black baccalaureates in the class of 2011 were the University of Phoenix and Ashford University.
That's correct. And, you know, we've seen in recent years a huge increase in people going to college of all races, but that has been particularly true amongst African Americans. I do think the numbers that college enrollment among African Americans went up 35% between 2003 and 2009. That's double the rate that white college enrollment went up. So it's a shocking and on its face, really great thing that's happening. But the problem is that those people are going disproportionately into these for-profit schools. And so you have a situation where the two largest bachelor degree providers are for-profit schools. And you have a situation where you're seeing enrollment. If you look at enrollment for African Americans in for-profit schools really over the course of the recession, 2004 to 2010, and I know people will say, well, the recession began in 2010, but it began in 2001 for black people. So from 2010, the black enrollment in for-profit schools went up 264%, and that's compared to a 24% increase in black enrollment in public four-year programs. So you can see that this rush into higher ed, which sounds great on its face, is really about a rush into the predator's jaws.
So we see that contrary to the stereotypes, blacks are heeding the admonition to get an education and sacrifice, but in doing so, they're, in your words, stepping into trap doors into poverty, not
That's
springboards
right.
to prosperity.
And it really is contrary to popular belief. And you see it, popular belief, unfortunately, driven by all areas, right? I mean, we see it ranging from, you know, when the president addresses Morehouse College and their graduation this year, rather than celebrating what is a remarkable achievement of these young men graduating from this elite university, he talks to them about personal responsibility and harps on these themes about where black men are failing, talking to a room full of black college graduates. And you see that all the way across our culture, you see it and across our political spectrum, this idea. But the reality is, I'm right now in the middle of a reporting trip looking at poverty in southern Georgia, and there's all of these people, all these black people who've lost jobs, 50-something-year-old black people who've lost jobs, who are going to school, who are saying, hey, you know what? Hey, what I hear time and time again is phrases like, well, God closes one door and opens another. I've gone back to school. And they've enrolled in local technical schools where the default rate on loans are 30% and up. There's no jobs for them to get when they come out of them. So people are, in fact, desperate and rushing to work, rushing to do things, but they're not being supported, and instead, they're being preyed upon in that.
Yes, and the value of these baccalaureate degrees is also in question as well in terms of their quality.
Yeah, I mean, the quote that stands out for me, I don't remember if it's in the piece, but from the Consumer Affairs Commissioner in New York City, they launched a whole campaign trying to educate people about think before you sign up for one of these schools because the problem had become so bad. There are bad players in any industry. Unfortunately, it appears to be the norm amongst for-profit schools. Now, the problem is that most of them are not, in fact, run by educators, or many of them are not, in fact, run by educators, certainly the biggest ones. So take Career Ed, for instance. It's run by a sports marketing CEO. They're often run by financiers. These are investors and people who saw money to be made in education, not people who sought to be educators. And because it's so easy to... You know, as with so many problems, so many of our regulatory problems, regulators are, by design, overwhelmed in their work. And so it's very difficult, say, in New York State for the state agency to meaningfully review each application for accreditation. So all that can happen is after there's been a problem, they can go back and police it. This is, in fact, if you'll spare me the tangent, precisely what the Supreme Court has just set up for voting rights. So that now if there's a problem, you can go back and police it. That's the problem that we have with higher education is once there's been complaints and once we've been able to establish that schools are doing things like, and these are some real examples, having people who teach courses in, say, engineering who have no training, not even high school level training in engineering, having textbooks that are from, you know, 20 years ago, things like that. Only once there's a complaint about that, then does the regulator have an opportunity to come in and check it out. But by that point, people have spent tens of thousands of dollars graduating with these meaningless degrees and are in trouble. And I'll add, there's a knock-on effect. So you graduate with one of these degrees, they're meaningless, you've learned nothing, and no one will recognize them, and you're loaded up in debt that you're now going to default on, which disqualifies you from future student aid. So as a consequence, they can never go back to school until they clean up all of this debt, which they now don't have the ability to do.
Huge social crimes such as this could not exist without public subsidies. You said that the regulators are reined in by lack of resources by design, but that means the federal government is complicit in this rape of hope.
That is true, though. I will have to say, now, one of the things that I have been amongst the writers and analysts who have been critical of a lot of stuff that the Obama administration has done, particularly in relationship to the black community. However, on this issue, they do deserve some credit. Education Department has been probably more aggressively, I guess it's not fair to say more aggressive than anybody else because it was only the Bush administration that came before them on this issue, but they've been relatively aggressive trying to rein this in now. So they've done a few things. Without getting too technical, they have tightened the noose on what you have to do to qualify for federal student loans. Because remember, these schools can't operate unless they qualify for federal student loans. The Senate, Senator Tom Harkin, did a study last year in 2012 that an investigation of about 20 of the largest schools, the largest companies, found 96% of their income, I believe the number is 96%, comes from federal student loans. So they couldn't operate unless they qualify this. So the administration has been trying to tighten the rules for qualifying for student aid. So amongst the things is if you have a school and of your students who graduate within 3 years, 30% of them are in default on their student loans, you no longer qualify for federal student loans. The Obama administration just created that rule. It used to be 2 years, but the proof emerged that the schools had been calling up their graduates and cajoling them into filing for forbearance, which is a really expensive way of kicking default down the road, right? So they would call them dozens and dozens and dozens of times, urging you file for forbearance, so that your default would fall outside of the regulatory window and they could stay, keep the game going. So the Obama administration caught on to that, watchdogs caught on to that, convinced the administration. They changed the rule last fall. So that's a good step. This is on their radar, and they deserve credit for that.
So in summary, we should view these statistics that show significantly black higher college enrollment rates in the same way that we should have viewed stats in the early 2000s that showed increased black home ownership. It was built on foundations of debt and crime.
Yeah, that is correct. And I would say that it's important to note that, of course, home ownership is good. Of course, education is good. There is solid economic evidence that these things are good, but they are not good at all costs. And the important point in here is that black people need homes, black people need education, black people need a fair deal to get homes and education, and it is the responsibility of our elected officials and our regulators to make sure that we get that deal.
That was journalist Kai Wright. A federal appeals court ruled last week that preventive military detention without trial is constitutional. The judges said a group of political activists and journalists had no standing to challenge the law because they could not show that they were in danger of being detained. Veteran journalist Chris Hedges is one of the plaintiffs.
Well, this is exactly what happened with the Supreme Court case. Amnesty International versus Clapper, the Supreme Court said that we didn't have standing because we couldn't prove that there was surveillance of our communication, something that Edward Snowden proved to be false, exposing the government lie. And I think that the same kind of dishonesty is at work here, where it would be extremely simple for the executive and the legislative branch to write into Section 1021 that U.S. citizens were exempt from being seized by the U.S. military, stripped of due process, and held in military detention centers indefinitely, but they won't do that. And they won't do that because they quite consciously want, in the event of social unrest, the capacity to use the military, contravening 200 years of domestic law, to carry out domestic policing. it's a very black day for those of us who care about constitutional rights and civil liberties. And this case is part of a series of assaults by all three branches of government, the legislative, executive, and judicial, against rights that make it possible for citizens to express dissent within a capitalist democracy.
And in fact, when the case was before the lower court, your lawyers asked the government over and over again to show why this statute could not be used against American citizens, against journalists like yourself.
The judge, Judge Catherine Forrest, asked the government attorneys repeatedly, can you guarantee that this would not be used against Chris Hedges? And they wouldn't do it. Now, the government changed their position when they went before the Second Circuit and said that what they called independent journalists had nothing to fear. But, of course, the question is, how do you define independent? If someone such as myself, as I have, interviews a member of Al-Qaeda, which I've done, and transmits that interview to the wider public, is that defined as independent? I think we have seen from the persecution of not only whistleblowers like Snowden or Manning, but journalists like Glenn Greenwald, that they don't consider that kind of activity, that traditional activity of the press, to be independent. So it was a semantic game that they played. They won, and it is extremely disturbing for those of us who care about a free press and an open society that the court decided to rule in the government's favor.
And in fact, that's just an interpretation by this president and not definitive as to what the law says. Another president might interpret it differently.
Well, it's pretty clear that what the Section 1021 says, and Catherine, Judge Forrest, in her 112-page opinion, laid it out, that it, in essence, and these are her words, permits the government to criminalize an entire group of people. And in her opinion, she raises the historical injustice visited on 110,000 Japanese Americans who were interned, stripped of due process in camps during World War II. She said that this section essentially opens up that possibility. The Obama administration has issued a signing statement saying they won't use this section against U.S. citizens, but that means nothing. That has no legal authority. The fact is, the law as it now stands permits the government to use the military to carry out acts of extraordinary rendition of U.S. citizens on U.S. streets, hold them in military facilities indefinitely, and strip them of due process. That's what the law says. And if they wanted the law to say something else, they could have written it differently, but they didn't.
And, of course, the Congress could rewrite it, but it hasn't.
This is the problem. I mean, this has bipartisan support. The bill was originally sponsored by John McCain, a Republican, and Carl Levin, a Democrat. Yes, of course, they could easily put in one sentence, which is that U.S. citizens are exempt from this process, in which case we would have withdrawn our suit. But they won't do it, and they won't do it for a reason. They want to accrue to themselves the ability, should they need to carry out these kind of draconian measures against a population that might be restive.
In terms of the legal challenge, there's only one place left, and that's the Supreme Court. But what other avenues are open?
Right. We will definitely appeal, but the Supreme Court is not required to take the case. So if the Supreme Court decides not to hear the case, then the law stands. I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know what other avenues we could pursue. And now it's essentially in the hands of the Supreme Court. And if the Supreme Court takes it, we will go to the court. And if they don't, then at that point, I'm not sure what our recourses would be.
Except, of course, the court of public opinion.
Well, you won't hear too much about the NDAA on MSNBC or Fox or any of the cable news outlets. It's an incredibly shocking assault against our most basic constitutional right, which is a right to trial, has been largely uncovered by corporate media because, of course, the corporate state very much wants this capacity, this legal capacity to seize American citizens as a kind of mechanism to ensure continued dominance of corporate power.
Former New York Times correspondent Chris Hedges. Educator and activist Dr. Cornel West says the acquittal of George Zimmerman in the killing of black teenager Trayvon Martin puts the evils of the American criminal injustice system in graphic relief. It also reveals the ineffectuality of the political class that claims leadership of black America.
I think that the precious life of Brother Trayvon taken away in the form of a legal lynching allows us to see what is systemic and what is chronic throughout the criminal justice system and its connection to the larger capitalist society. And this is therefore a very seminal moment. It's a very historic moment, and we have to seize the moment. It means that the kind of truth-telling that you and Brother Bruce and Sister Margaret and Sister Nellie and others have been telling has a chance now to become even more widely embraced because people are hungry for something that's critical of a system, not just some isolated event and not at just an individual level. So what we end up seeing is we see the moral bankruptcy of the black liberal leadership class that has been on the Obama plantation for the last 5.5 years, that's unable to give any kind of deep criticism of the system that could only highlight strategies as it's tied to the Justice Department, as it's tied to state legislators and so forth, where people get the sense that, oh my God, this thing seems to be so much deeper. It seems to be institutional and structural, not just individual. And it's very, I mean, usually it takes about every 25, 30 years or so for a moment to occur where you have this kind of opportunity to provide a more systemic analysis of our situation.
It seems that under our system of justice, all a person must prove is that they had fear in order to justify violence against black people. But most white people seem to have a deep fear of black folks.
No, I think that legacy of white supremacy still cuts so very, very deep in every nook and cranny. And I think the Obama campaign and a lot of the talk about post-racial America and so forth has been shattered forever. A lot of the superficial hopes that was tied to not just the black president, but the black political class being able to both speak truth and provide some kind of means to deal with black oppression and subjugation is now being radically questioned. And I think that that provides a real chance for the legacies of Martin and Malcolm and Fannie Lou Hamer and the others to come in very strongly, especially among the younger generation. You know, I look at the hunger strike that's going on in the prisons that you all have rightly been highlighting and needs to receive even more highlighting, and connecting that to the young folk taking over the governor's office in Florida, connecting that to all of the various manifestations of grassroots activism, especially among the younger generation. This is something that's very new for them. I mean, you and I, in a way, can take it for granted because we have strong historical memories. But for the younger generation, this is very new.
And despite the tragic circumstances, it was heartening to see so many young people involved in the in the protests after the verdict and before.
Absolutely. It's just that we have to just make the connection between the killing of our innocent brother Trayvon with the killing of innocent children by U.S. drones in Pakistan and Yemen and Somalia. When the president says we are a nation of laws, and you say, well, how come the laws don't apply to Wall Street criminals? How come they don't apply to the torturers and the wiretappers from the Bush administration? How come they don't apply to Evo Morales when his plane is turned back, which is actually a kind of act of war against the Bolivian people, violation of law? The level of lawlessness of the U.S. government, and then having the nerve to say we're a nation of laws, and the jury has spoken. No, it's a racist verdict. It's a racist jury. We do not have to accept it. And we see this among so many of the black liberals on the Obama plantation on MSNBC. Each and every one of them. I believe in the system. I think the system's the best system in the world. It just failed us in this instant. This is the first time I feel alienated from the state. You say, oh, you can see the degree to which you've been living in a bubble, or what you rightly call false consciousness, you know, coming out of Marx. You say, no. This is a 28-hour phenomenon among our precious black brothers and sisters when it comes to being shot, when it comes to being murdered, when it comes to being violated. And these are the kind of truths I think that we have to continue to tell.
These public personalities seem to have no problem with a system that has 1 million black people in jail.
Isn't that the truth? Destroyed two generations of young, precious black brothers, and they could hardly raise a mumbling word until now. And the fascinating thing is, oftentimes, the concern takes the form of, what do I tell my child? And so the white liberals, of course, are deeply moved because these are their best friends having to deal with the conversations with their children, and all children are precious. But you say, well, what do you tell your child? Wait a minute. Now, what has Jamal had to be told every day of his life while you were selling out? Now, that question is not raised, you see, because these kind of realities have been at work every day for the last 30 years. And yet now, all of a sudden, there's a crisis among the black liberal bourgeoisie about what they're going to tell their child. No, something is wrong. Something is deeply wrong.
Dr. Cornell West of Union Theological Seminary in New York. Prisoner support groups in California say leaders of the prison hunger strike have been placed in even deeper isolation, cut off from contact with even their lawyers. The inmates have been pressing a list of 5 demands, including an end to long-term solitary confinement, which is considered torture under international human rights standards. Ever Flores spent years in solitary confinement in Pelican Bay Prison's dreaded special housing units, or SHUs. Mr. Flores is now part of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network.
The first time that they started their hunger strike, 2011, you know, I've always felt, you know, pretty much that, you know, I was in solidarity, but quietly with them, you know. And I started noticing that, you know, people were actually standing up and helping the prisoners out, you know. So I just felt the need of having to step up and join them in their struggle, you know, because, you know, I was there, so I know how it is there. So I just felt that need.
What kind of actions have you been carrying out in support of the strikers?
Well, basically, we've been having a protest in front of various public offices. Actually, in interviews, just bringing out in the light, you know, the atrocities that they're committing.
You've been inside, and you, of course, are outside. Do most people on the outside who don't have experience in prison understand the kinds of conditions that inmates face?
Oh, no, no, no. Somebody that's never been there cannot really say anything about the place, you know, because this place is a modern-day torture chamber. That's what it is. I can't say the same thing for other prisons in California. You know, I'm speaking on this one specifically, you know, because of the amount of the silence and being totally alone, isolated.
You're speaking of Pelican Bay?
Sure, Pelican Bay, the SHU, Security Housing Unit.
Many folks say that solitary confinement is designed to destroy men's minds. Is that your experience?
Definitely is, sir. Definitely is. I mean, that's one of the main reasons that I'm doing what I'm doing, you know, because I've been affected by it. You know, I'm still treating right now as we speak. You know, I'm under medication, pretty much, you know, just going day by day, you know, and it was caused by this situation, you know. And I'm not the only one, you know. I've seen a few of my friends actually go totally insane, you know. I was fortunate enough to have a stronger mind to be able to deal with it, you know, and my friend actually didn't, you know. I've actually seen him eating feces and just totally just go insane, you know, in front of us. So that was very heartbreaking for us, you know.
At the height of the hunger strike, about 30,000 inmates had joined. What kind of ramifications are there for prisoners who join a hunger strike? What does the administration do to people like that?
Oh, wow. You know, that's one thing I would like to focus on, you know. And I know that they pretty much cover up their tracks, but for us, when we're in there, you know, we're pretty much confined. We can't say nothing. We don't have no communication. So they take advantage of that situation. You know, one of the situations is they actually cut off any human contact total. You know, it isn't, you don't even have much what it is in Pelican Bay. But they cut out any further communication. They might move you cells, throw you in a dungeon type, what they call like a different pod. You know, that's totally for members of different races that are like maybe starting, or they call it inciting, starting some sort of a strike or stuff like that. They put you in these places right there, and it gets pretty hectic in there, you know. Sometimes they even strip you of your jumpsuits. You got to be in boxers. You know, you'll get lucky if you get a blanket, because, wow, when they turn that air conditioner up, they turn it up. It gets cold in there. Basically, all it is, you know, is just retaliation for whatever you're getting involved in, you know. That's what they do.
And we're told that the only way you can get off of solitary confinement is to debrief, which means snitching on other inmates, whether you have anything, any information or not.
That's a policy that CDC has that I think is totally wrong, because in my situation, I was sent to the SHU, which is a security housing unit, because somebody decided to say a lie about me. You know, they went and said that I was dealing some sort of narcotics in the general population yard, and they believed this inmate, and I ended up in the SHU. Fortunately for me, I had what they call a determinate SHU program. You know, I had a specific amount of time that I had to do there. So, you know, I was fortunate that I stood there for a number amount of years, and I was able to get released back to general population. For some of the inmates that have an indeterminate SHU program, those are the inmates that they take in for debriefing. And the reason I'm challenging this is because anybody can say anything about anybody else. If somebody's been there 10 years, 5 years, or whatever, and they want to get out, they can just easily just say a big old lie about somebody else and screw the other guy over, and they get a chance to go back to general population. You know, it's not totally accurate, and most of the time it's not even true. So they got to tell on people what the CDC wants to hear so they could further condemn another inmate, and they'll let this other inmate out into a protective yard. You got to remember, you know, some of these guys, you know, they're not angels, so, you know, they're going to say a lot of stuff about people that ain't true, you know, and I think that's wrong. I think that's totally wrong.
Prison officials are saying that people in solitary are somehow forcing other folks to go on hunger strike. How is that possible?
That's not possible at all. Each one in there, you know, you're your own man, you're your own person. You know, I'm pretty sure everybody in there is sick and tired of living the way they're living. And it's a self-choice. It's a self-choice. Nobody's going to force anybody into doing anything that they don't want. You know, that's just another way that the CDC would probably leak out into the public, so, you know, everybody will look down on the prisoners. That's just something that CDC will put out there for inmates to seem like, you know, they're actually involved in something else instead of an actual hunger strike.
The response inside the prisons was much stronger this time around than in 2011. Why is that?
Well, people get tired. It's just tiring. You live in a little cell for an enormous amount of years. It makes you sick in your mind, you know. And if you feel like you're in the brink of just cracking, you know, just going insane, you have to make a call out there. You have to make a call so people can actually hear you. You know, it's a call of desperation. That's what it is, you know. And these are people. These are human beings that do not deserve this. Not even animals have this kind of treatment. I mean, you get animals. You kick a dog on the street, you're going to jail. Not even animals get treated like this, you know. You go to a dog shelter. The dog shelters are clean. You know, they got their food, they got their water, they're treated with love, you know. Not even animals are treated like this. And I don't think humans should be treated like this either.
Now you're on the outside. How do inmates on the inside know that people are out there supporting them?
Concretely, I wouldn't think that they would have first-hand knowledge. You know, they would have to probably just see the media or some family or friends.
And how receptive has the media been to reporting on the hunger strike?
Certain medias, you know, are doing a great job. I wish it would be out there even more, because these are humans that we're talking about. We're not talking about animals. We're not talking about a zoo. We're talking about human beings actually being tortured in modern-day America. I think this should be spread out in a much larger scale. I just wish that other medias would get involved and just blow this thing up so people can actually see what's really going on and what is California doing to human beings.
That was Ever Flores of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. Attorneys for People's Lawyer Lynn Stewart are hoping to get a hearing on her request for compassionate release from prison. Stewart is suffering from stage 4 breast cancer. The Obama administration turned Stewart down, claiming that her health is improving. The request is now before Judge John Codall in New York, the man who sent Stewart away for 10 years for the crime of zealously defending her client in the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center. At the time of the sentencing, Judge Codall said that he didn't want Stewart to die in prison. Ralph Pointer, Lynn Stewart's husband and lifelong comrade in struggle, has been spending his days in Washington in front of the big house at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
While we're continuing the resistance to the incarceration of our sister and all political prisoners who have unbridled faith that we will get them out. And so they told us we can stand in front of the big house or work in front of the big house because we were made for that, and we did it for 300 years. And so now I am in front of the big house on behalf of Lynn Stewart and all political prisoners, spreading the message along with you, because you know the major media is not going to give us a platform. And people ask me, well, what type of media do you get? And I say, well, I get media from Canada, media from Japan, media from Iran, media from Brazil, and the march goes on and on. No media from America, except that the media that you are providing at this moment and the medium that you have been providing over the years. We can expect no more.
One of your lawyers, Ramsey Clark, has knocked on the door of the big house, that White House you're in front of, and on the doors of the Justice Department, but there's been no positive response.
They turned a cold ear to it, and they said, see us in 6 months. She still has a year to live. They want to give her the Marilyn Buck treatment, release her a week or a day before she dies. And we must struggle on because, as Lynn says, I'm just small potatoes. We have brothers and sisters who have spent many years behind the bars, behind the walls. And I don't call them prison camps. I call them death camps because our political prisoners, those who were working on our side, are dying through lack of medical treatment. And as Lynn says, we don't have medical treatment on the outside. How do we expect medical treatment on the inside?
How is Lynn holding up psychologically and physically?
Psychologically, Lynn is fantastic. Physically, she is dying a little every day. She just got out of quarantine, and when they refused her compassionate release, she was still in quarantine because of her white blood cell count was too low for her to be in population. They can no longer give her the treatment that they gave her because the side effects are too great. Doctor examined her the other day and said she has blockage now in both lungs. And Lynn, when I wondered what will it be like, you know, to talk to her about dying, she was very casual about it. She says, we all die. Everything that ever lived dies. And she was interested in what dying would look like in terms of her physical disabilities. Period. Her mind is shot. She struggles on. She's guiding her defense from inside herself. There is nothing wrong with her mentally, and this is what I was afraid of. And she is not afraid of death because Russell Means' wife has said Russell came to her in a dream and told her to visit Lynn Stewart and to assure Lynn that she has nothing to fear because he will be Russell Means, the head of the American Indian Movement, who died 4 months ago, will be there to guide her transition into the next world. So Lynn felt that was very touching, and she feels she is in good company of all of those who fought to make change, make this country be what it said it was, and she's proud to be a part of that struggle.
Ralph Pointer in front of the White House. The war in Syria grinds on, fueled by arms and money from the United States and its allies in Europe and among oil-rich Arab royalty. Dr. Gerald Horn is a professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston. We asked Dr. Horn, how does the U.S. rationalize its arming and financing of Islamic jihadists in Syria and Libya while at the same time claiming to be engaged in a worldwide war against them?
I think that what happens is that U.S. imperialism feels that it can use the jihadists to depose a particular regime and then pivot and isolate and marginalize the jihadists and put in neoliberal forces. Now, that strategy has not been working. Look at Libya, for example. And I think that perhaps that may lead to a rethink on the part of Washington.
Well, Washington may rethink, but what other foot soldiers does it have available to itself in the Middle East and Northern Africa?
Well, that's a good point. From Washington's point of view, the value of the so-called jihadists is that they're fearless, they're reckless, death does not frighten them. In some cases, it inspires them. And it's very difficult to find forces of that nature. And so they're very useful. They earned their spurs, as your comment suggested, in Afghanistan. And as a result, in some ways, they're the only game in town.
Except when they no longer take on the job assigned to them, as seems to be happening in Libya.
Well, that's the problem when you create a Frankenstein monster. That is to say, Frankenstein can turn on you. I mean, look at the back and forth in Afghanistan, which is something of a demonstration project for what we've been discussing. As you noted, there was an alliance between the United States and these forces, actually going back before the Soviet intervention. Recall that the intervention in Afghanistan actually starts in 1978. The Soviet intervention is in December 1979. You may recall the pictures of National Security Council leader Zbigniew Brzezinski to President Jimmy Carter standing on the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan with some of these forces, looking through a sniper's rifle from Pakistan into Afghanistan. And this force, the so-called jihadists, were used to destabilize this left-leaning regime, the People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan, to the point where the PDP found it necessary to call upon their Soviet friends to intervene on their behalf. And then, of course, the United States escalated in turn. And before you know it, there was a raging war taking place. And it's interesting to note that the last left-leaning leader in Kabul, Afghanistan, Najibullah, was only captured and executed by the so-called Taliban after then-Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev had decided to pull the plug altogether on that regime. Not only, of course, withdrawing troops, but withdrawing all kinds of aid. And interestingly enough, the Obama administration in 2013-2014 basically feels that it has learned the lesson, so that with regard to their puppet, Mr. Karzai, they feel that even if they withdraw troops, if they continue pumping in aid, that Mr. Karzai can basically stand up to the Taliban. That's the lesson they've drawn from their own experience with regard to the People's Democratic Party and the Soviets in the 1980s and early 1990s. We shall see.
Of course, there have been jihadists around for a very long time. It's a tendency, a trend in Islam. But there was nothing that we could call an international jihadist movement until it was funded by the CIA and the Saudis and given logistical help by the Pakistanis.
Well, the point you make is well taken. I think that at the end of the day, your grandchildren and mine will clearly come to the conclusion that the decision to, quote, weaponize religion, unquote, that is to say, to inflame religious passions against communism, so-called, and then to inflame it even more against non-communists like Mr. Gaddafi in Tripoli, Libya, was a fateful decision by the North Atlantic forces. I think at the end of the day, they will have helped to create a force that will be bedeviling them for some years to come, and that in retrospect, the events of September 11, 2001 may seem like a Sunday afternoon picnic compare to what some of these forces have for the North Atlantic countries in decades to come.
Even in the pages of the New York Times, which was wholly enamored of the jihadists in Libya, and initially so certainly in Syria, even there we are seeing information that appears to indicate that the Syrian people, there is a serious backlash against the jihadists in the country.
Well, what the New York Times is reflecting is the fact that serious rifts have developed amongst the anti-regime forces in Syria. I'm sure you're aware of the fact that some of the more extreme elements basically massacred some of the leaders of the so-called Free Syrian Army, which the United States basically supports and backs. We know that in light of the coup, and I'll use that term, in Egypt, that coup exposed and revealed a serious rift between forces backed by Saudi Arabia and forces backed by Qatar, the sponsor of Al Jazeera television network. As of now, the Qatari forces are on the back foot. As of now, the Turkish forces, which also backed President Morsi in Cairo, are on the back foot. Whereas the Saudi-backed forces, particularly the so-called Salafists, who make the Muslim Brotherhood of President Morsi seem like Girl Scouts, they seem to be advancing. And I'm not sure if that is wholly in accord with all quarters and circles in Washington or on Wall Street. In many ways, future analysts may determine that in some respects, the Saudis, and to a degree the Qataris, were like the tail wagging the dog with regard to U.S. policy. We know that the United States and its North Atlantic allies are in a bit of financial and economic difficulty right now. We know that the Qataris in particular have been pumping small fortunes into the economy of both France and Britain, which may help to explain why those two countries have been so supportive of the lifting the arms embargo, the European Union arms embargo against Syria. We know of the economic relationships that have evolved between former French President Sarkozy and the Qataris in particular. And it does not take an oracle or a seer to deduce that this money that the Qataris, and I should also add the Saudis, have been pumping into Western Europe may be helping to shape North Atlantic policy as a whole. And I think that the inclination basically to see the North Atlantic forces in charge and basically the Saudis and the Qataris dancing to their tune, that particular scenario might be out of fashion.
And of course, it is the fact that the Qataris and the Saudis are rich that has led to them having their own armies of jihadists. But other than being recipients of Saudi and Qatari funds, what do the jihadists have in common with these royal thieves?
Well, it's interesting. I think that it's well known that the Saudis in particular feel that they can defuse and diffuse the anger of their youthful population by basically sponsoring them in adventures abroad, be it Afghanistan or Libya or whatever, and that buys the Saudis a bit of time. That is to say, rather than having these young men, they're mostly all men, at home in Saudi Arabia, basically operating under the old-time premise that idle hands are the devil's workshop, that they'll sponsor them abroad. And that also dovetails with the interests of the Salafists in particular, who deeply influence many of these young men. And so voila, you have basically a marriage of convenience between the Saudi regime and these militant forces.
Which can lead to situations that are not necessarily in the interest of the United States.
Well, yes. I mean, September 11, 2001, is a keen example. But on the other hand, I think that from a cost-benefit analysis, which is basically how things go in Washington and in Wall Street, they may have made a cost-benefit analysis that the price that was paid on September 11, 2001 from the cold calculus of numbers was worth it when you consider the benefit. That is to say, the benefit, as they would see it, from deposing Gaddafi in Libya, the benefit, as they see it, from weakening the al-Assad regime in Damascus. They've basically taken off the playing field to a degree, one of Israel's major antagonists. And we know that two key determinants of U.S. policy in that part of the world are, one, Israel, and two, oil. And by basically placating their Saudi allies, by dancing to their tune, they basically, as they see it, guarantee a reliable supply of oil and petroleum. So in some ways, it's like a virtuous circle from their point of view.
And despite the fact that the U.S. is in a de facto alliance with the jihadists, they still remain a pretext for the war on terror.
Yeah, isn't that something? I mean, I think that historians of the future will wonder about some of our analysts, why they weren't able to pierce that veil, why they were not able to see that the so-called war on terror, which is soaking up billions, if not trillions, of our tax dollars, is taking place in conjunction with and alongside an alliance with those who the United States is supposedly at war with. It's really quite curious. I think that it's well known that the United States has long practiced what is considered to be coercive diplomacy. I mean, think back to the era before the fall of the apartheid regime in South Africa in 1994 and the policies directed, for example, against Mozambique, where on the one hand, the United States supposedly had normalized relations with Mozambique. On the other hand, they had covert forces supplying the so-called Mozambique National Resistance, or RENAMO, that was seeking to destabilize the Mozambican regime. So Janus-faced foreign policy, two-faced foreign policy, hypocritical foreign policy, is par for the course in Washington.
Professor Gerald Horn of the University of Houston. Black Agenda Report managing editor Bruce Dixon set off a firestorm when he criticized anti-racist author and lecturer Tim Wise for booking a paid engagement with Teach for America, or TFA. Teach for America provides a huge proportion of the instructors that are replacing veteran teachers in schools across the country. Dixon, in an open letter, says Wise is, in effect, giving an anti-racist pass to an organization whose mission is racist to the core.
Tim, thanks for pointing out the error in last week's piece. Your Charlotte TFA gig is the 29th, not the 19th, which does give us a little extra time to talk about this. We do understand, though, if you don't want to talk. You've had my number since last Wednesday and you haven't called yet. It's okay. You recently told the Grand Rapids Institute for Information Democracy that diversity training for a predatory corporation just results in more black and brown faces in the room. Quite true. So even if people of color inside Teach for America had invited you to do this gig, it still wouldn't matter. Black military officers, black BP and ExxonMobil execs want a friendly workplace too. They don't want their bosses looking like out-and-out racists while they invade countries, run secret prisons, rob the world, and pillage the environment. So they sign up internal diversity trainers, and they look for ways to appear superficially non-racist, even though their core missions invariably devastate communities of color more than anywhere else. That is how the game is played. Given this, stamping the anti-racist ghetto passes accurately describes the service you propose to perform for Teach for America. Who better for the public relations end of it than an ostensible leftist? The argument that if you did not consult for TFA, somebody else would, is precisely the same as saying, because it's there. That's not a reason, Tim. It's an excuse. You say you know full well the issues with TFA and their model, but in 3,000 words, you never spell them out. Why? Given the rank dishonesty Teach for America and its foundation and corporate allies use to push their agenda of educational privatization, if you can't tell us what those objections are, it looks like you're doing an Obama, inviting us to read our own views into your silence. Plenty of Obama-supporting liberals are on the corporate school reform and privatization bus. Cut to the chase, Tim, and tell us whether you're one of them or not. Teach for America is a key player in the bipartisan elite scam of corporate education reform aimed at de-skilling and dispersing public school workforces to soften them up for eventual privatization. The mostly white TFA temps who get only 5 weeks training to do 2-year terms as missionary ghetto teachers are not better than the educators they replace. And nobody ever does this kind of things with white suburban schools. That's not racist? Come on, Tim. The TFA model enjoys the blessings of the foundation world, the business community across the country, and the Obama administration, whose Race to the Top program is hollowing out public education, closing public schools by the hundreds, and pushing the drive to privatize along at a record rate. If you imagine that the harm reduction of your TFA diversity consulting outweighs the evil of the crusade to destroy public education, which you help validate, contribute to, and strengthen, then you are awfully full of yourself. This is way bigger and more important than Tim Wise. We at Black Agenda Report have always opposed the drive to privatize education. In the past, we promoted your books for free, published your columns, even provided you space to answer one of your critics. Your decision to cash in your anti-racist cred to be Teach for America's diversity consultant was a decision to step between us and the longtime target. So even though it's not really about you, Tim, you can get some too if that's what you really want. You can get out of your deal with TFA if you really want to, Tim. We really hope you do. By the time Teach for America changes from the inside, there won't be any public schools left. But there still will be plenty of business for diversity trainers, even if diversity, rather than reducing the harm that evil institutions do, often gets us more effective evils. For everybody else, please sign the petition asking Tim Wise not to stamp the ghetto passes of Teach for America this July 29th at www.blackagendareport.com/TFA. That's www.blackagendareport.com/TFA. If you've already signed it, please forward it to someone else to sign between now and July 29th.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda TV. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Greg Russ.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.